Welcome to another episode of the Staying Stories podcast, where we interview alums about real experiences at Milton and beyond. My name is Teddy Ellis, and it's my pleasure to introduce the following conversation with Dr. Sam Myers, a graduate of Milton's class of 1983, who went on to study history and science at Harvard, earned his Doctor of Medicine at Yale, before returning to Harvard for his Master's in Public Health. Today, Dr. Myers is a principal research scientist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and also serves as the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance, an organization focused on addressing the impacts of human disruptions to Earth's natural systems on human health and all life on Earth. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. How was your Milton experience?
It was good. It was sort of brief because both my brother and sister went to Milton and I had no interest in going to school with my brother, who was 3 years ahead of me. So I went to Roxbury Latin School through ninth grade until he left. And then I switched over and went to Milton for 10th and 11th grade. And then I did school year abroad and went to France my senior year. So I was only there for 2 years, but it was actually far and away the best school experience I'd had up until that time, which wasn't saying a lot because I went through the Boston Public Schools in the middle of desegregation and busing. And I hated Roxbury Latin School. So when I got to Milton, I was really, really happy. And yeah, I really loved it.
What were some of the activities that you were involved in on campus?
You know, I played sports. I played soccer and squash and was on the sailing team. And I wasn't a particularly fabulous athlete, but I really liked that. I think the thing that I did most was the speech team. So I was on the Extemp team. And that actually was an incredibly valuable set of skills for me because now what I do is spend a lot of time talking. And so giving lectures and giving talks got a lot less stressful from just learning how to do it on the speech team.
During your time there, was there a teacher or a faculty member who impacted you significantly?
Yeah, there were. You know, the teacher who I really remember who had the sort of biggest impact on my career was Tom Dolger, who was my 10th grade English teacher. You know, when I was in 10th grade, I wasn't that interested in science. I wasn't that good at math. I hated physics. My father's a physicist, but I hated physics. And then I took a chemistry class that I liked quite a bit. And I got kind of interested in biology, but I always thought I was going to be an English teacher or a writer. That's what I really loved to do. And Mr. Dolger was my English teacher and sort of a quirky guy. And he kind of made it clear that he wasn't sure I was cut out to be an English teacher. And he suggested that I read this book of essays by Lewis Thomas, who is a physician and a biologist who wrote The Lives of a Cell and The Medusa and the Snail, these sort of collections of essays. And they were just these absolutely lovely essays that were full of sort of precision about observing the biological world and recounting the science, but with a sense of wonder and whimsy and humor that I just found totally infectious. And the idea that you could sort of blend an interest in biology and life with that kind of delight about the natural world was really exciting to me. And so that actually sort of started veering me away from the humanities in the sense of that was what I was going to do and more towards biology and ultimately medicine.
In that vein, what do you believe was the most important thing that Milton taught you?
I think that what a good high school teaches you is how to think for yourself, how to pursue your own curiosity. It's not about learning knowledge. It's not about getting answers. It's that knowledge can be pursued and that the sort of quirkiness of your own ideas and curiosities are worth pursuing and that that experience can be done well and with discipline and with diligence and take you really interesting places. And so that sort of pursuit of your curiosities can be a lifelong activity as opposed to just like, oh, I need to find the answer for the test. I think that that attitude about exploration and pursuing curiosity is probably the richest and most important thing that I got from Milton. Milton. I think learning how to write was right up there as well. But it's something I worry a little bit about sometimes now, because I feel like the sort of playing field in education has gotten so intense, and the pressure that you guys are all under around colleges and jobs is so intense that there's such a focus on performance and grades. And I didn't feel that so much back in ancient times when I was in high school. And I felt the freedom to just sort of say, yeah, my questions are interesting questions and I'm going to pursue them, as opposed to, well, wait, I don't know if that's going to be on the test, or I don't know if that's part of, you know, what I'm supposed to do. So that permission to explore my own curiosity was what I would say.
And finally, on the Milton front, what is your favorite memory of Milton?
My favorite memory is springtime at Milton. The world just became magical. I sort of worked my tail off in the fall and through the dregs of winter, and usually felt like I'd kind of gotten myself in a decent position around my workload. And when I first started smelling the apple blossoms and the lilacs, my brain would sort of go to mush. My ability to really work effectively would go to mush. And it was sitting out with friends and talking about ideas and just screwing around and enjoying each other's company and feeling spring in the air and how sort of beautiful it all was. When I think back to sort of happiest moments, it's springtime kind of liberation and just excitement that was so special on that campus.
So Dr. Myers, you graduated from Milton in 1983 and then went on to attend Harvard. How was your college experience?
It was hard. My parents split up right between high school and college. And so that obviously was sort of an emotional hit. I found Harvard pretty cold as a place to go to school. I think one of the weaknesses of Milton, and certainly a huge weakness of Harvard, is that you've got so many kids that are pretty ambitious. There's a permission to put your ambitions ahead of building community and just hanging out and building friendships. And that's even more intense at Harvard. And so, you know, trying to get a pickup ultimate game or a pickup soccer game organized where everyone just comes together and has fun, or cooking a meal together, was always really hard. And the idea that, oh, I've got a paper to write, or I've got this personal thing, was sort of an acceptable excuse. So I felt lonely a lot. I also felt like there was a lot of mutually insured insecurity. Where like all these kids were really talented and they were all really intimidated by each other. And so that they kind of puff themselves up and talk about their achievements and reinforce the other people's insecurities in the process. And so it took me a long time to start to build meaningful friendships. And my parents, having gotten divorced, may have contributed to that. It's actually the period of time where I have the fewest really close friendships that I can point to in my life. I kind of wasn't engaged socially at Harvard as much as I wish I had been now. And instead, I really focused heavily on my major, which was history of science. And I had a minor in biochemistry. And I just dove into academics and learning and then got off campus, spent a lot of time hiking in the White Mountains. I would say I think I would have had a better undergraduate experience a lot of other places just because of that lack of warm, connected community. It wasn't a great fit for me at the time.
The tension you describe between community and getting work done is unfortunately present here as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned your focus. How did you eventually choose your major?
Choosing my major was pretty easy. Choosing to go to medical school was much harder. I was not sure what I wanted to do at Harvard, but I found history of science really, really interesting. Where do our scientific constructions come from? To what extent are they influenced by sociology and power and perspectives on how we see the world? You know, we think of them as sort of this monolithic, it's just truth, you know, it's just establishing empirical truth. But of course, you learn very quickly that it's much, much more complicated than that. And I ended up writing my thesis about understanding of mind-body relationships. And I found it fascinating that they were deeply understood in an important part of medicine in the sort of 1850s, 1860s, and then completely disappeared from medical literature at the turn of the century, to the point where they were sort of rediscovered as a brand new phenomenon in the 1930s and the discovery of the placebo effect. And yet, if you go back, you know, 80 years earlier, there was really strong recognition of these interactions. And so how does knowledge suddenly disappear and get rediscovered? And what was the meaning of that knowledge for the legitimization of the medical profession and all the things that were going on that were sort of sociological? Anyway, I found all that really, really interesting, but I was very conflicted about what did I want to do with my life and ended up debating between wanting to be a wildlife veterinarian, wanting to be a biologist, being interested in human physiology and medicine, figuring out how do you bring together these interests in sort of nature and people. I got a lot of mentorship from E.O. Wilson, who was teaching my favorite course at Harvard in evolutionary biology. And he had office hours and was very generous with his time, and very few people used his office hours. And so I would just go in and chat with him. And he ultimately was sort of the one that said, you know, maybe you should do this from the medical side and get trained as a doctor and then see if you can't figure out the synthesis with environment and nature, but have the credential of a medical degree if you're really on the fence about how you approach it. So I think that was probably good advice.
How was your experience at medical school at Yale?
It was good. I mean, I chose Yale for a couple of reasons. One, the first 2 years, there were no grades at all. There was no ranking of the class. You took your exams anonymously and you just had to report yourself if you failed. So I really liked that. And the other reason was that it had a super strong school of environmental science. So I was interested in pursuing those interests at the same time. And that worked out really well. I made super close friends with the School of Forestry and Environmental Sciences. So that was just a really, really fun period of my life where I was learning medicine, but making friendships with folks that were doing something completely different, which meant they were sort of interested in what I was thinking about. And I was really interested in what they were thinking about. And we shared a love for environment. I really enjoyed it. And I really loved New Haven.
And how was your residency at UCSF?
It was good. I mean, again, I think I learned something after choosing to go to Harvard in my own backyard and started to get more focused on what made a good experience. But I was excited to go out to San Francisco. And I actually, a lot of my friends were going in different ways. So it's kind of a whole crowd of us went out to the Bay Area. And it was a fantastic fit for me because it's a very strong internal medicine residency. But it's in the middle of one of the most fun places to live on the planet. And it's a place where things are really accessible, which matters in residency. So, you know, we would get out of the hospital and go up to Mount Tam and go for, you know, runs in the moonlight and just use the outdoors a lot. It's also a really great residency program because it's spread across 3 different hospitals. So there's a VA hospital, San Francisco General, which is a sort of classic big inner city trauma center hospital, and then Moffitt Long, which is sort of the big fancy tertiary care hospital. And so you get very, very different patient populations in those 3 centers. You know, vets are sort of a world unto themselves, and classic diseases of abuse of sort of a lot of alcoholism, a lot of smoking, and lung disease. And then you've got an inner city hospital with a lot of homelessness, a lot of immigrant communities, really interesting ethnic communities. And then Moffitt Long, which is sort of the wealthy Bay Area, you know, people with really complicated illnesses. And so it was nice to rotate across those centers and see their cultures and different populations. And everybody sort of would end up with a hospital that they felt most at home at. It was a good place to do a residency, although I had also was broken up. I did 2 years of my residency and then I left to go to Tibet for a couple of years.
And that was actually my next question. Could you describe the process of leaving your residency for that project in Tibet?
It was a kind of unusual thing to do, I think, especially then. I mean, the dogma was you never leave your residency, and if you do, they'll throw you out. I had built a relationship with a guy back at Yale who ended up advising the government on creating a new national park on the north side of Mount Everest called the Chomolungma Nature Preserve. We'd stayed in touch, and it turned out he was bringing a delegation of Tibetan officials to visit the Western U.S. park system as sort of part of thinking about how they were going to administer this huge Denmark-sized Park. And so he was out in the Bay Area and invited me out to dinner one night when I was in the middle of residency. And when I sat down, I was sitting next to the health minister for the Tibet Autonomous Region. And on my other side was the vice chairman of the Communist Party for the Tibet Autonomous Region. So two very senior officials in the administration of the country. The health minister and I talked for quite a while. And towards the end of the evening, she said, I'd like you to come and run this development project in the Chomolungma Nature Preserve. And I sort of was like, wait a sec, I don't know anything about how you do something like that. I'm completely not trained for that. I'm learning how to do sort of tertiary care medicine in a rich country. I don't know anything about how to do public health in a really poor country with very few resources. There are different disciplines, there are different populations. There are so many people that would be really great at that, but I'm not one of them. And I thought that was it. But then we talked some more and she's like, no, I'd really like you to come run a project across 350 villages in a place the size of Denmark with very, very few resources, almost no doctors. Think about how to improve the health of 200,000 people that are living in this preserve. And I said, yes. Then I kind of went home and thought, oh my gosh, what did I just sign myself up for? I went into residency the next day and said, I just agreed to go to Tibet for 2 years. So I get it if you want to kick me out. They actually said they would allow me to hold a spot. And so I knew that I had that spot. So that's how I ended up agreeing to go to Tibet.
That's amazing. And so that project was successful?
It was the hardest thing I've ever done. I was living in a little village called Tingri that was about halfway between Lhasa and the Nepalese border on what was then a dirt road that took 2 days to drive from where I was living to Lhasa, to the capital. It was at 16,000 feet, so it was cold, sort of deserty. I was living in a hut with a mud floor, sharing a communal latrine with the rest of the village that was disgusting, with no running water. And I was intensely lonely. There was no internet. Mail really didn't make it to Tingri. Communist China controlled Tibet, so everything was censored. I was the only Westerner allowed to work outside of the capital city, out of Lhasa. So there were all these people from like Doctors Without Borders and CARE and, you know, these NGO groups that were basically held down in Lhasa by the government. So I was the only person out there. I didn't speak Tibetan, so I had a translator who was working with me when we worked. But the rest of the time, it was me sitting in this village by myself. The food in Tibet is really bad. You know, the staple food is what's called sampa, which is roasted barley ground into a flour. And then you have a little sack tied to your belt made out of the stomach of a goat or a sheep. And you pour the barley into the sack. And then you pour pucha, which is black tea with rancid yak butter and salt. It's disgusting. And so you pour that into the sack and you roll it together into a ball of paste. And that's your meal two or three times a day if you're Tibetan. I didn't eat that. So I would bring food, you know, when I came in from the States, jars of peanut butter and tins of tuna fish and things. Every time I left, I weighed about 130 pounds, which is about 40 pounds less than I weigh now. So I looked like sort of a concentration camp survivor when I'd get home. So it was very intense that way. In terms of the actual work itself, it was successful. I mean, we created this thing called the Pendaba Project, which apparently is still going on. The idea was to explore the connection between sort of conservation and public health. Training these Pendaba, these village-based workers who would educate villagers about both primary health care and conservation practices. But yeah, it was very hard, and I think it was successful. And I think it taught me something about the enormous complexity of trying to do project work in other cultures and other countries. Taught me a lot about what it means to live in poverty. Of all the places that I worked over the ensuing years, there's nowhere I've worked that was just sort of poorer. I mean, incredibly rich in culture, incredibly rich in smiles and happiness and family connection, but just absolutely impoverished financially and with so few resources. So it was a huge education for me.
After returning home from Tibet and completing your residency, what led you to go back to Harvard for your MPH, and how did you end up where you are today?
Yeah, I finished residency. I lived out in San Francisco for a few years and practiced. And then I went and did the AAAS Science and Diplomacy Fellowship. So I worked at USAID for 2 years. I worked for Conservation International for 2 years. But ultimately, that sort of 6-year stint where I was in Tibet and at USAID and at Conservation International, all of those years were working at the sort of project level in communities, poor communities, exploring the intersection of environment and health, of sort of natural resource management, population issues, and human health. Ultimately, I sort of realized that the issues that I really care a lot about, which are our global destruction of nature and how it is undermining human well-being as well as the rest of life on Earth, that addressing those issues project by project wasn't going to get us there. That the change that's happening is happening at a pace and a scale that we're not going to reach by going from village to village. And that furthermore, the people in these places where I was working understood these connections between natural systems and their own health and well-being way better than I ever could understand them. They lived them. So the reason that they were, you know, dynamiting their coral reefs or using cyanide to fish was not because they didn't get the connection that if the fisheries collapsed, their children would have nothing to eat. It was that they had sort of 0 degrees of freedom in the decisions that they were making, that they needed to feed their kids the next day. And that's all they could think about. And the only way they could do it was through these destructive practices. And so as a white guy from Boston going and explaining, hey, this stuff is all connected, like they didn't need that. They got that. So it made me feel like I was working at the wrong scale. To answer your question, why did I go back to Harvard? I went back to Harvard and I did this NIH-funded clinical research fellowship because I wanted to get training in epidemiological research because I felt like we needed a whole field that was focused on these interconnections between the state of our natural systems and the state of human health, and that you couldn't create a field without having sort of an evidence base and a research set of activities sort of at its heart. And so how do you do research in this area? And I didn't really know that. So it was time to go learn how to do research. And that's why I came back to Boston and did my MPH and started to do epi research.
So how would you describe the field of planetary health?
Yeah, so the field is new. It's about 6 years old. It's a field that focuses on the human health impacts of our disruption and degradation of all of our natural systems. So it's not specific to climate change, although it often people think it's about climate change. It is about climate change, but it's about the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth, biodiversity crisis. It's about global scale pollution of air, water, and soil. It's about land use change. It's about scarcity of resources like fresh water and arable land. It's all the ways that our collective activities are transforming our natural systems at a global scale. And those systems and those changes are interacting with each other to affect really sort of core conditions for health and well-being. And so it's mapping those connections between our disruption of natural systems to the health effects across every dimension of health.
And we've read, you know, you've conducted research on these connections, whether that's, you know, CO2 emissions, pollinators, declining biodiversity loss. Right now, are there any specific environmental factors or conditions that you are particularly concerned about for the future?
It would be easy to say, yeah, I'm really concerned about climate change. And I am. I'm also really concerned about biodiversity loss. And I'm really concerned about pollution. That's kind of the point, is that if you diagnose a single thing, you know, if you say the problem is climate change, well, then the treatment is renewable energy. It's pretty straightforward. We need to transition to a carbon neutral energy economy. But does that get us out of the set of issues that I'm worrying about? Actually, not really. And so we'd still be concerned about an erosion of our life support systems, even if we could stabilize the climate, because we're driving species extinct, and you know, because we're changing biogeochemical cycles, and because we're polluting our atmosphere and oceans. If you say the problem isn't climate change, it's everything change. If that's the diagnosis, then the treatment is to move upstream and say, we need to reduce humanity's ecological footprint. And that requires deep, rapid structural shifts in how we live. And it's not just our energy system. It is our energy system, but it's the food system. It's how we manufacture goods and the idea of sort of circular economy and circular manufacturing. It's how we design our cities and the need to build green cities that reduce our ecological footprints. And so I think it's actually important to get the diagnosis right so we get the treatment right. And part of that is not identifying a single environmental cause that we need to focus on, but saying the fundamental problem is the size of our ecological footprint. That's the root cause, and it's ballooned beyond our planet's capacity to, you know, absorb our wastes or provide the resources we're using. And that's what's making this transformation of natural systems. So we need to get that back under control. There are lots and lots of, you know, ways that we can do that and tons of solutions that are sort of within grasp, but that's what we need to do in order to live, you know, in balance to protect those systems and regenerate them so that we have viable life support systems for ourselves and the rest of life on Earth.
For individuals who are concerned about their ecological footprint, but, you know, maybe aren't the decision makers at an oil and gas company, is there any sort of approach or, you know, mindset that you'd recommend?
I sort of break it into three pieces. You know, the first thing you can do is the personal that you're talking about, the sort of personal audit. So how do I live? That includes, what do I eat? You know, am I mostly eating sort of plant-based foods, which have lower ecological footprints and, by the way, are better for me? You know, how am I getting around? Am I walking and biking and using muscle-powered, you know, locomotion? How do I consume? You know, am I limiting my consumption? Am I not buying stuff sort of on impulse, but because I actually need it and will really use it? And these are all elements of our own personal ecological footprint. And so we need to make those decisions consciously. There's that personal audit. And that gets a lot of attention because it is within our manageable interest. I sometimes think it gets too much attention because at the end of the day, those individual actions aren't going to get us where we need to go. They're helpful, but they're not enough. And so the second level is, what do I do professionally? You know, if you're a student, that can mean, what do I choose to do with my career? And it's not limiting in the sense that, you know, you can have ability in the humanities, in the arts, in government, in law, in the sciences and engineering and technology, and all of those skills are highly relevant for this idea of what we call the great transition, the shift in how we're living on the planet. And so there are lots of different ways to put your shoulder to the same wheel, but thinking about, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I actually think it's an unbelievably exciting time to be in high school or college, because this is the generation that's going to be addressing whether we make this great transition or not and contributing to that. So what do you do with yourself? In some ways, maybe a lot more relevant than what you eat, for example. And then the third thing is, find your partner. Ultimately, this isn't all going to happen from individual action. So it's going to require collective action. And, you know, your example of the fossil fuel company, you know, that's a power problem. Fossil fuel companies know that climate change is occurring. They know that fossil fuels aren't good for the world. They've actively denied that. They've funded that denial science. So more knowledge isn't the problem, right? What's needed there is power. Somebody has to make them stop doing what they're going to do. And building power takes collective action. So that's movement building, it's organizing, it's getting people around the country to vote out politicians that are denying climate science. So there's a huge kind of power dimension. And the other great thing about collective action is it both addresses the problem, but it also addresses the personal problem that many of us face of sort of apathy and sort of feeling overwhelmed by the size of this problem. And by working with other people, there's sort of a mental health intervention that can be actually really powerful as well.
And with today's news cycle so saturated with stories around the environment and climate change, as a scientist, is there anything that you feel that popular media discourse gets wrong about the environment or our climate?
I think that what the media has the hardest time getting right is that this moment is still being reported as if it were a series of discrete conversations about particular environmental problems. So there'll be a discussion of COP26 and the climate problem, and that will be, you know, reported as its own issue. And then there'll be a discussion about the extinction crisis and biodiversity or global scale pollution or something about the oceans. What's really exciting about literally this year and this moment that we're in is the world is starting to recognize that what have been a series of discrete conversations about these particular environmental problems are morphing into a single conversation about the scale of our ecological footprint and about social justice and human survival. And so instead of being a sort of tree hugger conversation about protecting polar bears, people are coming to recognize, no, that's about having a livable future. And when you recognize that, you know, your grandchildren having a livable future is at stake, what you're seeing in COP26 and the COP15 biodiversity meeting and the UN Global Food System Summit that just happened is this broadening of coalition, so that instead of just the environmental groups showing up for these conversations, you're seeing the global health community, you're seeing, you know, indigenous peoples group coming to the conversation, and they're all sort of building a much broader coalition to say, hey, this is about our future. So I'd love to see the media kind of catch up with what's really at stake in this conversation.
And going off that coalition building, do you feel that your work or the emergence of the study of planetary health has had a tangible impact on environmental policy or collective action around these issues?
I think we're making some headway. You know, we're a young organization, but yeah, I mean, this week I had a meeting on Tuesday with 23 different organizations across 9 countries in Europe that are all working on planetary health and all have started major activities in the last year or two. We had the European Environment and Sustainable Development Advisor Council that advises the entire EU and also the national governments that was sponsoring this meeting with us. So there's a huge sort of ferment of activity around planetary health and planetary health policy in Europe. The next day, I gave a presentation to the World Federation of Public Health Associations, to their governing council, which represent all the major national public health associations in the world. And they agreed that you couldn't have public health without planetary health and sort of endorsed that statement and started to work on how do we integrate planetary health into public health thinking and education. So United Nations Development Program has just decided that they're going to frame some of their major health efforts around planetary health and just published a bulletin on planetary health last month. So there's really starting to be traction in the policy community, and the private sector has also been increasingly engaged. So we're working with a bunch of companies as well as big coalitions like the World Business Council on Sustainable Development that work with other big companies, and planetary health is part of now their agenda. So I think we are seeing that concept really begin to kind of penetrate in the policy and private sector worlds. And that's really the function of the Planetary Health Alliance, which is the alliance that I'm directing now, is to both support the growth of this very young and rapidly growing field, but also to help mainstream the new knowledge and the conceptual frameworks coming out of our field into the world of sort of action. So into the policy domain, the private sector, out to the general public. We're very focused on that now.
Final question. Do you have any advice for a Milton student who may be interested in working in the environmental sector in the future or getting involved in these sorts of issues?
I'm not exactly the poster boy for a kind of linear career path. I've wandered all over sort of exploring my own curiosity and interests and kind of come to this. But I think that learning some strong concrete skills. It's tempting coming out of a place like Milton to be a generalist, but especially if you're sort of junior, you want to have a skill set that you can bring to a team and make a contribution. And whether that's being a great artist or a great graphic designer or being, you know, a real hotshot at you know, modeling or artificial intelligence or having a deep understanding of organic chemistry. You know, it doesn't really matter, but having one really clear area of expertise and then finding a team where you can contribute that thing. That's how I've engaged most effectively with students who want to work with us, who come and say, look, I'd be really good at helping you do this, as opposed to just saying, I find all of this really interesting. How can I contribute? Well, there are lots of people who find it sort of generally interesting, but I don't know how you can contribute unless you tell me what skills you bring to it. But I think the most important thing is figuring out what you really are passionate about, figuring out what you care about, and then getting excellent at it, working hard to be excellent at something, and then make the connections, as opposed to sort of trying to find a recipe for, well, if I do this and this and this and this, then I'll get to that place, which I think almost always goes awry and leaves you a little cold. So follow your passion and then figure out how to connect it with this. And this field is so broad that, you know, there's a way to connect it to almost anything.
Dr. Myers, it's been a pleasure to hear about your experience and perspective today. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right, Teddy, nice to meet you, and thanks for your interest.
This has been Staying Stories. Thanks for tuning in.